Officially starting. Ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, good. Hi, this is Adriana Cisco, and the date is February 23rd, 2021. I am conducting an interview for The Country, remembering Lexington's first lesbian bar, and I'm here with Karen West today. I am located at my home in Lexington, Kentucky for this interview, and Karen is over in the Lexington Diner itself, over in Lexington, Kentucky as well. And, well, first, Karen, thank you for joining me today for the interview.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. And first, for the record, would you mind spelling your full name out loud?
Certainly. Karen Ann West, K-A-R-I-N-A-N-N-E, West, W-E-S-T.
Okay, got it. Thank you. And thank you. And to start things off, how about you just tell me a little bit about yourself, just basic information?
Basic information. I would self-describe as a little bit of a gypsy. I spent most of my adult life traveling around the United States, living in about 10 different states. Part of that time was with my family. Part of that time was while I was in the military. And part of that time was kind of on my own independently after I got out of the service. So I've lived in about 10 different states. I grew up in Lexington, Kentucky from the age of 14 on. And went to middle school here at Jesse Clark and attended Lafayette High School. So I grew up in the Lexington community here and consider this home. And from there, I graduated from UK and actually also went into the military from that. So once I finished my degree, I was an MP in the Army. So I went from being way out of the closet here in my life in Lexington to going into a very closeted world. And that was 1996, 1997. And since then I have gotten out of the service and spent half my career in social work. And then later on went on to get a business degree at Antioch up in New England. So I actually have a master's in business, and somehow after doing corporate management for about 10 years, found my way into the restaurant business. And the restaurant that I'm sitting in now is Lexington Diner, where I've been for now 7 years. Actually, we will have our 7th anniversary at the beginning of the month.
Oh, nice. I didn't know that. Cool.
Yeah, it'll be the 3rd of March will be our 7-year anniversary.
Okay, congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's been one of the best, the worst things I've ever done.
Okay, cool. We'll get into that, definitely.
Okay.
All right. So it sounds like you've been a lot of different places. You mentioned, 10 different states, all these different professions that you've done. But you mentioned that you mostly like grew up in terms of being a child in Lexington. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, I would say as a teenager, that time period.
Okay. And what would, just generally speaking, like what decade would your childhood in Lexington have been?
Oh, so that would have been the late 80s. So I graduated from high school at Lafayette in 1990. So nice job kind of not really asking me my age. But
I was trying to be graceful. I was trying to be graceful, but I was also trying to just get the setting, because I wanted to hear in your own words, what was Lexington like during that time period?
I mean, really, I don't have a point from the time. I really didn't come out until my mid-20s. So that's kind of when my reference kind of picks up. When I was in college at the University of Kentucky, I was actually married at a very young age of 18. And that marriage ended after 5 years. And then it was probably the 2 years after that was the process of me coming out into the Lexington community. So I would say back then, I mean, I started developing friendships with other people that were identified as gay. And I think 141 was probably the primary club that I would go to back in those days, which of course doesn't exist anymore. It's another one of those, bars in the community that unfortunately we've lost over the years.
Okay. And so when you were much younger, as in when you were growing up as a little kid, I just want to get a sense for what you remember being aware of as a kid in terms of, like, did you ever hear about other people who were gay, or was that not really a topic that was discussed or kind of known at that time? Did you know that word at that time?
I really didn't know that word at the time. And I mean, gay at that point in the late 80s was really thrown around as an insult. And that's what the word was used for mostly, I would say, in the late 80s. That was, and I really didn't understand, I didn't really even understand it, why it was an insult, you know, and why people would throw that around. And so it was not, unfortunately, and I think that's why, you know, I think for me, coming out was a later thing. I consider it later now. I mean, now I know people that have come out in their 40s, 50s, 60s. So I thought I was a late bloomer coming out at like 25. So, you know, things are very different now, and there's a lot of people that come out later in life, but it really wasn't even part of the world. I mean, I remember, I don't even remember what year it was when, Ellen came out on her original sitcom and how they then canceled the show. And it was over. She came out and it was over. I mean, I didn't really, and I think my younger years in Lexington, gay didn't even exist to me. And I think that was a big part of what kind of retarded my coming out process.
Gotcha. And so when did it become part of your lexicon in terms of, like, it exists, I know people live this way? Was that during your 20s? Like during the,
that was more, yeah, that was more during my 20s. I started meeting and making friends that identified more as gay. I did not have that in my life prior to that. And meeting more people that identified as bisexual as well. So I think kind of opening up that conversation and having this be something that I could actually talk about with people.
Okay. And tell me about the sort of 20s, mid 20s coming out process.
It was fun and rough. We'll put it that way. So, I mean, I was really, I think, out in my 20s when I came out. I was mostly out to my friends and my coworkers. I was out to my brother, who's about 5 years younger than me. And, you know, and progressively came out to more of my family members over the years. You know, I think my parents probably took the longest. I mean, I knew my dad's response was going to be okay because I knew he had gay friends. So I wasn't as nervous about that. But my mom did not have the same kind of exposure to people. And my stepfather was not really friendly. you know, the word gay was a joke around the house. So I'm not sure if that answers your question or not. But
it absolutely does. Yeah. And I was just about to ask a follow-up question, actually, of... were you sort of entering, when did you enter the actual, like, so-called, like, gay dating scene? And, like, when did it sort of enter your dating life, relationship?
I would say I probably was, like, 1995, 96 is probably when I really was coming out into the gay scene and meeting other people and going to Club 141. And at that point, started having more friends that identified as gay or bisexual. And, you know, that first date with another woman and first girlfriend, all those things that, you know, you kind of feel like you're just stumbling through it because you don't know what to do. Yeah, I was in college at UK then. So everything after that just went really fast.
Yeah. Okay. And so I have two follow-up questions for that. Well, briefly, tell me about Club 141, because you're... one of the few people who's mentioned that one to me, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was actually my favorite club. I mean, it's down on the city block that was the infamous block downtown. As a Lexingtonian, you know that block was empty for years. And it was kind of like that. It was a smaller club than the bar. And it was really, I was primarily there for dancing. And they had one small dance floor and they had a DJ and they did have drag there and strippers. It was a little more intimate, I think, than the bar. And then at that time, I'm not even aware if, I'm sure Crossings existed at that point, but it was not a space for women. So it was not a place I even considered going. And we would go to the bar occasionally, but because at that point I was like going out to dance clubs probably about 5 nights a week. I mean, and if we could have found some place to go dancing on Sunday nights, we probably would have gone. And we would go to Cincinnati quite a bit to go out to the clubs there too. So. But yeah, 141, I mean, it was just, it kind of was, I don't know, the kind of like the neighborhood gay bar. The main floor had, you know, a dance floor and then a bar there. And then there was a bar in the back. And then there was a kind of over a level above that kind of looked over the dance floor and the rest of the bar. But it wasn't terribly big. But I mean, that's probably some of my best memories from Lexington when I was coming out, was at that bar.
And was that a more of like a women's skewed place, or was it mixed men and women? What was sort of the demographic?
It was definitely a very mixed demographic. Yeah, mm-hmm. Most definitely.
And you mentioned at the time you and your people were going out, you know, 5 nights a week or so. And if you could go somewhere on Sunday, you would have done that too. Were these, was it mostly the gay bars like Club 141 or the bar complex you would go to, or would you also go to like other spaces?
More straight spaces. Yeah. I mean, we would go wherever there was good dance music. So, okay. You know, a lot of nights, you know, we might start out at Club 141 and then end up going somewhere else, but we would go, and I had friends that were gay and straight, so we would frequent gay and straight places, wherever the music was good.
Okay, gotcha. And you mentioned some of this coming out process and just kind of like living your life process happening when you were going to UK, and so I wanted to ask, what was UK like when you were there as a student?
I was actually a member of a group called UK Lambda when I was there.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure, have you heard about that group at all?
Yes.
And I'm not sure. I think they still exist if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. But it was a small group there on campus. And I actually started attending the meetings and then ended up getting, I kind of got pulled into the group and I ended up being the co-chair of the group. So I was the co-president. It was myself and another, gosh, I can't remember. The other co-president was Matt. I can't think of his last name right now. But he and I were co-presidents of UK, of the UK Lambda group for the last 2 years I was at UK. And the big push then was we would hang posters up for our meetings every week all over the student center and stuff. But they, you know, would rip. I mean, they'd get ripped down. So we'd hang them up. They'd get torn down. So that was just kind of this ongoing battle. So we just kept hanging up more flyers. And we developed quite a good sized group that would come to our weekly meetings. And so that was a really good period of time for me. And we did have some problems with a UK fraternity that kind of there had been a hazing incident where they had come and attended our meetings and used some threatening language with the people that were in the room. And it happened to be a day where we had a meeting about HIV and AIDS. And so very obviously protecting the people that were participating in the meeting was really of utmost importance to us. So, and that kind of became a whole thing at UK at the time. So we had, you know, campus police got involved. We had to meet with the dean and then, you know.
Yeah. What was the outcome of just that incident?
Oh, I mean, it was barely a slap on the wrist. It was the outcome. You know, I mean, you know, I guess, you know, the threat of, you know, it was probably, I think by memory, it's probably about three to four, maybe six young men from the fraternity came in and attended the meeting, and we had a speaker, and, you know, they were disrespectful and disruptive. And obviously they were there for other purposes than to be educated about HIV and AIDS. And their intent was really to intimidate. And so, I mean, it was really about at that point kind of ending the meeting as gracefully as we could and getting our people safe, because the room we were using at the student center then was only had one door. So there was one way in and one way out. So I think at that point, my thoughts kind of went to making sure everybody was safe at that point. And nobody was hurt, but it definitely, you know, was very traumatic for a lot of the people that had been there. And it ended up being having a bigger conversation, you know, on campus.
Right, understandably. And so how did you find out about the Lambda group? Like, did you find out about it through friends or a flyer on the wall? Like, how did you learn about its existence?
I believe I found out about it from friends.
Mm-hmm.
That I found out about the group, and then I kind of started attending, and then they're like, oh, well, you know, we're really looking for new leadership. We don't have any. Nobody wants to take this on. I'm like, oh, okay. You know, classic lesbian mood. I'll do it. Sure, I'll do it. Why not? You need somebody to do something, I'll do it.
True. Yeah. And what did you all, I mean, I guess you mentioned some of it, but what did you all typically do? Like, you had meetings and you would sort of advertise these meetings. It sounds like you would have a lot of different topics that you would discuss at each of these
meetings. Yeah, a lot of times we had guests that we invited to come in and talk about different topics. We had like a sex positive, like, kind of like mini kind of conference where we had people coming in from different organizations around Lexington that was focused on sexual health. You know, obviously AVOL was involved in that at that time, and Planned Parenthood was there and some other groups. And we kind of had this kind of mini conference there. And then we'd have different topics. We talked about, we had a speaker series. I haven't thought about this in a long time, honestly. We had a speaker series that we did on campus where we had a bigger room where we invited other people to come in and talk about topics like religion, and homosexuality and the gay community, which was a really good thing. And so it was mostly topic based. We'd have a topic for each meeting and people would come, and there was a social aspect to it as well. I mean, a lot of us were friends. We'd hang out together. We had a few parties over the years. Usually Halloween parties were what we did. So
that's a classic.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, everybody likes to dress up, right?
You gotta have a Halloween party.
You gotta have a Halloween party, if nothing else.
Yeah. Okay, and so after UK, what happens in your life? Like, what's the next step once you graduate?
After I graduated from UK, I went to the Army. I left there. So I graduated from UK in 97. And left for the Army in August of 1997, and actually turned 27 while I was in basic training. So, I had a girlfriend at the time, and she, you know, we kept in touch for the time I was in basic and writing letters back and forth. And you know, unfortunately, once I kind of got into my life in the military, I realized it was going to be really hard to maintain that relationship with what I was doing. And my life was very different from all my friends that were back here in Lexington at that point.
Yeah. Paint me a picture of your life at that point. Like, what would sort of a day in the life be like for you then?
A day in the life back then when I was in the service would be, you know, getting up early in the morning and putting on the uniform or going to do PT. And I was an MP, so we would either have road duty, which meant kind of like patrol on a base, which most people will think of, but the majority of our duty was actually field, and it was combat MOS, which I didn't know that when I joined. And I was like, wait a minute, I thought I was going to be driving a patrol car. So, I had some crazy ideals at the time. I actually was working with the Lexington Rape Crisis Center as a phone counselor at the time, right before I went into the service. And I thought, well, you know, there seemed to be a big disconnect between law enforcement and the Rape Crisis Center and advocates that were working with the victims. And I said, well, you know, if I learn how to do this job as a police officer, maybe I'll understand better why things are this way, you know? And then that maybe we could create a problem, basically have a liaison, which of course, by the time I got out of the military, those liaisons now exist. So that's kind of how I, some weird train of thought and fear about student debt. That's kind of how I ended up there.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, yeah, put that all together. But, you know, it was being in the military, you kind of, even when you get to reception or going through basic training, I think gay people, we kind of find each other and things are not necessarily, I think somebody asked me if I had a pride flag on my car at home. And I was like, what? Do you have a pride flag? And because our freedom flag, I forget what they called it, and I didn't understand what they were saying. I'm like, what are you talking about? And then finally, you know, it all clicked and we figured out, oh, so you start identifying other people that are, you know, that are gay, that you work with or are stationed with, and so you kind of create this small circle. But I mean, that was very, you know, for me, very protected and guarded information, because it wasn't okay to be out, and there was actually witch hunts going on when I got to my first duty station in Fort Lewis, Washington. I got there and a friend of mine had warned me. She's like, hey, just so you know, watch out, they're looking. So
yeah,
what so that was under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Yeah.
Oh, don't ask, don't tell. Yeah. So what would the specific, I mean, I can imagine, but what would the specific consequence be if they like found you out? What would happen?
I could be dishonorably discharged from the military. That was the consequences from the military side, you know, because I kind of wasn't playing the game, you know, I wasn't dating to their eyes. They didn't see me dating anyone. And, there was a lot of dating in the MP community within the group. And I wasn't doing that. So people left notes on my door, under my door. I had my tires slashed. So I was threatened. I had a few friends that knew that I was gay. But aside from that, I went from being way out of the closet when I was with UK Lambda to going back in the closet. And it really didn't agree with me very well. I'll be honest. It was really hard. And I remember, you know, I was older at 27 going into service. A lot of the people that were joining were, you know, still 18, 19, 20. And I remember a gay young man that came to me. He's like, I don't want to be gay. I don't want this life. I'm like, I said, well, it's really not as bad as you think. And I remember this conversation with him, and it's like, it's really going to be okay. But the problem is the world that you're in was very anti-gay at the time. I remember at basic training, we actually had a training one day about the military's policy on gays. It was, and they called it, actually the name for it was institutional discrimination. That's the class, institutional discrimination. And that was a really hard day. I was like, wow, there's a whole class about how they hate me. Awesome. So, but those were interesting years, you know?
Yeah, sounds like it. And how many years total was that you were in there?
I was in the service for 3 years.
3 years. Okay. And what prompted you to, what sort of like put that period to an end?
What prompted me to join or?
Well, how did it end essentially? Because you 3 years. So what happened?
Oh, how did it end? It actually ended because I was injured in the line of duty. And so I did not fulfill my contract. I had original contract of 4 years, but I was injured during a training accident. And I couldn't physically do what we found after like a year and a half of treatment and surgeries, that I really couldn't do the physical performance that I needed to do for my job. And they eventually medically discharged me.
And so you were in there for 3 years. It came to an end because of that. And you mentioned that, you know, there were times obviously that were very like threatening and unsettling and tough. But I imagine there were, you know, some reasons that you were there, especially for 3 years. What made you stay? What inspired you to stay for the three years that you did?
Well, contracts help. You know, contracts help a lot. But, you know, I don't think I kind of saw it as in any other job, like I was taking a job, and it's not a job, it's a life. It takes over your life. And I don't think I really anticipated that. But I think, you know, really what kept me there, I'd always had this call to service when I was young. I always felt this call to service. So the fact that I ended up, and not necessarily the military, but whether it was paramedic or firefighter or police officer, I always have been drawn to kind of jobs like that at that age. And so that's kind of how I ended up there. Okay. And that's kind of why I stayed, you know. But eventually, you know, after my injury and I just couldn't recover, it kind of turned what had been it to kind of a bitterness, you know, because not only was I taking personal attacks, you know, for the they are drawing the conclusion that I might be gay, and I was being threatened for that, and then now, well, she's different, she can't do the job, you know. And you know, so it's being gay, being a woman, and in the military, and an MP, and all those things.
And so what happens, well, actually, first you mentioned the being a woman and MP thing. Was that mostly men in those positions, or was it seen as
it was a pretty good mix, but I think, you know, any position in the military, you have to deal with a lot of gender norming. So, you know, so it's just like, you know, women were there, and there was this belief that women couldn't do the things that men could do. And there was things put in place trying to compensate for that. They, you know, to try to create a standard for women. So there was a standard for women, and there was a standard for men when it came to like physical activity. You and I can probably sit here intellectually and say, oh, yes, men and women are physically different. They're capable of different things. But I mean, so the best way to tell the story is to tell you how I got hurt.
Okay.
I got hurt because we were doing a traffic stop, and this was basically role-playing scenario. I was out with my partner. We were doing a traffic stop, and we believe we're stopping someone who had stolen a car. So we get both of these guys out of the car. My partner goes out and handcuffs the first guy, and I'm going out to handcuff the second guy. Well, the second guy, I'm like 5'6", and I weighed about 140 pounds maybe, and this guy is like over 200 pounds and like over 6 feet tall, and he's huge. And I kind of said, stop action. Hey, in the real, because we're supposed to do this like it was the real world. Well, in the real world, I wouldn't have handcuffed this guy because there's a bigger guy behind me that's going to be the one that's going to do. Didn't make any sense. And I said something about that, and they're like, no, you need to do it, because they saw it as me trying to dodge me doing my job instead of common sense. So anyway, that's how I ended up being injured during that training. And so that's kind of the things I'm talking about, that you kind of had to fight every day, and really that you had to do everything you could to be pushed to be better than the men so that you could just get along, you know, so things would go smoother. You would push yourself to do the very best that you could do to be better than the men, just because, so you didn't have to put up with the bullshit that you would get for being a woman. How dare you be a woman and be here? Oh, how dare I want to serve my country? You know, so sorry.
Uh-huh. I get you.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And so after the Army, the 3 years it ends, what happens next for you in your life after that?
Oh, I wanted to run away. I really wanted to run away. I pretty much did. A friend of mine was getting out of the service at the same time, and we packed up and drove from Washington State, Fort Lewis, where we were stationed, to the Florida Keys. And I spent the next year in the Florida Keys after I got out. And I said, I'm never going back in the closet again. I'm not doing this again. I will never be in a job where I can't be myself ever again. So, I mean, it was a very powerful thing in my life.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so what did you end up doing for, you know, in the years following that, what did you end up doing for jobs? Because you mentioned like a bunch of different things when you were introducing yourself, and we've gone through only some of them.
Yeah. I mean, I spent the next decade in social work. I worked at a domestic abuse shelter. So I kind of went back to those roots because I graduated with a degree in sociology, and I should have been a social worker all along. But I went back and was doing work with domestic violence victims and with rape crisis victims when I was in Florida. And then, of course, in order to live there, I lived across the street from the beach. So you have to have multiple jobs. So I worked at a crisis stabilization unit at night. I did a radio show on Friday nights at a local bar. And then I worked at a store called The Lions Den. I don't know if you're familiar with those on Sundays. It's an adult store. It's an adult store. It's a chain of adult stores. So I worked at an adult store on Sundays. That was tied in with the radio job. And then I think that's all I did there. I think that's it. Yeah.
That's it.
I think that's it. And I was there for a great year, and I did kayaking every weekend and worked like 3 or 4 jobs to make a living and kind of to recover from my time in the service.
Okay. And you mentioned, you know, sociology in UK and then going back to your roots in terms of rape crisis center, work in domestic violence, social work. Does that relate to your sort of drive to do like service work? Like why those sort of concentrating in those areas? Because it seems like you came back to them, you know, multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been drawn to do that kind of service work. When I was here, when I was in college, I worked at the Rape Crisis Center as a volunteer. And then I also worked at Planned Parenthood as an educator there. I mean, that was one of the really important things to me and always been, is making sure that people are educated about their sexual health and that they can make well-informed choices. Is something that's always been very important to me. But then I spent another 6 years doing child protective service work up in Maine. So before I really kind of embarked on a new career in management. So, but I think that's always been a part of my life. And even now, I kind of joke that I'm still a social worker. I have 28 staff members that work for me. And trust me, I do counseling almost every day. what it feels like having a restaurant. But, you know, it's a very, after doing 6 years of doing child protective services, I really was ready to do something different. And I mean, my life felt like a Lifetime movie every day, you know, where people thought child abuse was something, oh, they just see that on TV and they talk about it. But for me, it was almost 400 families that I visited in 6 years. And I really had come from a place where it's like, I can't do this forever. And that's kind of how I got into operations management. So,
okay, yeah. Tell me about the transition to operations management. Cause I think you mentioned that you have a degree in business. I think it was.
Yeah.
And I assume that's kind of like in that path or something.
Yeah.
Like
that was why I was in Maine. I had a really good advisor when I started in my job in child protective. And she told me, she's like, if you have any desire to do anything else, you should pursue it. She goes, this is the best you can hope for if you stay in the field. I'm like, oh, okay. Okay, well, I have some other interests. So I ended up getting a degree in my master's in business from Antioch University while I was working in child protective services. And really, my goal was to be an executive director at a nonprofit at that point. But they didn't get me. They didn't understand. They're like, they just in their minds, I couldn't transition from my case management work to doing being a director. They just couldn't see me in as a management role. They're like, no, you're a peon, you go talk to clients, you're not in management. So I had to kind of leave that world to get the experience I needed.
Okay, gotcha. And eventually at some point this loops you back to Lexington.
yeah at some point that loops me back, you know. I spent about 3 years in Pennsylvania managing a company there called VetSource, which is a veterinary pharmaceutical company. I helped them start that company and was there for about 3 years before I came back to Lexington. So, and once I was here, it was a few years later that the diner came about when we started downtown.
Okay, gotcha.
And I started that with my former partner, Renata Riley. That would have been 7 years ago.
Okay, yeah. And before, you know, Lexington Diner started, was there something else that was in this location, like another business, or was it just like empty?
In the Lexington Diner location currently? What? Yeah, the one for the country location. This location has, from what I know of it, has mostly been a restaurant in the spot since the country was here. Mm-hmm. There was Friends and Company was here. I think the restaurant that most people Lexingtonians remember is Friends and Company. That was here for a long time. It was kind of like that neighborhood bar kind of vibe here. I did not ever come here at that point. I can't even tell you exactly what years it was here. And then after that, it was Brasa Bana, which was a Cuban-esque restaurant. And then they were here for about 5 years. And then the diner moved here 2 years ago.
Oh, downtown. Okay. Gotcha. So you all, as in Lexington Diner, used to be downtown and then you moved into this space.
Yeah. Yes, we moved into this. Yeah. So our lease ended downtown and we needed an opportunity to get out of there, you know, and have the things we have here, which is now we have full bar. Now we have 4 bathrooms and parking, you know. Just a little thing, you know, that we didn't have downtown.
Okay. And you mentioned, you know, some of the businesses that had been at like the current Lexington Diner location, like the country location. You mentioned Friends and Company, yes, et cetera. And I think before the interview, you mentioned that typically these businesses in this space have been gay owned. Is that something you heard about?
I don't know that this space that they had been gay owned. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm assuming the country was gay owned.
It was.
I mean, that only makes sense. But I don't know. And I don't know a whole lot about Friends and Company. I do not think that's true. Okay. And Brasa Bana was not gay owned. So, okay.
Yeah.
I've got about 20% left on my battery.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, let's get into those Lexington Diner questions.
Okay.
So, what brought you into owning Lexington Diner? We'll just start there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, my partner was a chef, and we had met when she was working at Natasha's downtown. And she had moved from that job and to a country club and had got helped them get to the point where it was profitable and that it was actually sold. It was sold. So she ended up losing her job while we were on our honeymoon getting married. So when we came back, so she had no job. And here we saw a chef. We have a chef now with no restaurant. And we had actually been talking about with family members. It's like, what about opening like a food truck or something, you know? So opening something was kind of always in the back of her mind. And then we came back and she's like, well, do I look for a job working for somebody else? And then we were approached about a couple different spaces that were coming available downtown. And we were kind of flirting with the idea of kind of opening something. But of course, had no clue how we were going to finance it and how we were going to make it happen. And of course, very quickly after that, within probably a month of returning from our trip to Hawaii, and then she came home to be terminated as her wedding gift. We actually signed the lease in January of 2014 and opened Lexington Diner at the end of February of the same year. So literally opened it in like something crazy, like 42 days after we signed the lease.
And that first location was downtown, you mentioned, right?
Yes, it was on the corner of Upper and Short. That's our first location.
Okay. And when you all moved into that location, was it you all that came up with the name Lexington Diner, or is that a pre-existing sort of name?
No, that was something that we had come up with. We really wanted something that we didn't want to define ourselves right where we were, you know, and a name that was going to give us some, without really having built the history ourselves, kind of give us some standing and some history with the city. So, well, Lexington didn't really have a diner per se. I mean, we've got Ramsey's, which is technically, they say it's Ramsey's Diner, but people know them as Ramsey's. They don't know them as a diner. So we wanted to, I really always felt like a diner everywhere else I lived, having been in 10 different states, that a diner was a really important part of the community. So we ended up, after having a party at our house, naming it Lexington Diner.
Okay, gotcha. And earlier you mentioned that, before the interview started, you mentioned something about like the Lexington Herald sort of disclosing that this like gay-owned business forever. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we were open, we were kind of cautious about, we didn't want to make it a gay restaurant. You know, this was 2014. Yeah. We wanted it to be a restaurant, not a gay restaurant. And we were kind of conscious of, you know, we both have senior parents and wanting to make sure that we are mindful of making sure of keeping them safe. And we realized if we came out publicly at that point in time, that there could be some kind of backlash. You know, it really wasn't the emphasis. You know, the people that knew us in the community obviously knew that we were a gay couple, but it wasn't like, hey, we're coming. It wasn't going to be a giant coming out party, you know, and we weren't going to announce, hey, we're here and we're queer and this is a gay restaurant, so come see us. So we just wanted to see us because we're a restaurant. We serve good food. And then we did an interview around the time that we were opening.
Oh.
And that took pictures and all those things. And we actually never even spoke about the fact that we were gay or married or anything. So I'm not really sure how they got their information.
Wow.
They actually identified us as a couple in the article when the article came out, and we didn't get to preview it. And, you know, it had a great picture of us sitting in the dining room, the two of us together, which was kind of an ambiguous photo. But yeah, it was never our intent to come out like that in the Herald Leader. It was a pretty big picture, but that's how it happened.
Okay.
So,
yeah, and what did you think after that happened? Were you like, oh no, or were you like, oh, it actually went fine? Like, how did you feel after the article?
I was like, well, we're just going to hope for the best. Because after that phone, actually, I don't know where I have it, it's tucked away. And we actually did have some harassment that happened after that article came out. That was something that we were trying to avoid. So being identified as a gay-owned business, you know, we had some threatening phone calls come in. We actually had someone take the effort of sending us the article and marking it and putting some really pretty words on it and sending it to us in the mail. And I mean, of course, when we had to go through, for the safety of all our staff, we had to go through contacting local law enforcement and making them aware of the situation and making them aware there had been threats. You know, and we were very fortunate. Nothing ever really came from it other than threatening phone calls and a letter. And we really didn't have any problems. But periodically we would have people come into the diner downtown and just, you know, make disparaging, hateful comments, you know, and about the fact that we were gay owned. And those things kind of just happen just randomly. And not the times when you think it would happen, like maybe gay pride when we're flying the flag, then, you know, at that point they've already outed us. So we were pretty involved with gay pride downtown. Oops, I'm losing you. Sorry. We were pretty involved with gay pride. So anyway, but that's kind of how that started. I mean, it all turned out okay. Everybody was safe, nothing, but it was really just mostly verbal threats.
Okay, gotcha. Did that change? I know you mentioned 2 years ago you moved to your current location. Have the threats, occasional, sporadic, random kind of threats, has that changed within the past 2 years with the location change, or not really?
Has not been an issue, really, since we've been here. I think getting out of downtown, I mean, I think that location kind of made us a little bit more vulnerable to having people come in and make those kind of threats. We really haven't had, knock on wood, I haven't had any issues here.
Okay, gotcha. And 2 years ago when you moved to the current location, was there anyone like in there at that moment, or was it, you know, empty for you to come in and, you know, decorate, remodel, do the whole thing?
Bra Sabana was here at that time and they had closed down in October. And I actually created a new partnership with them when I moved here. They kind of needed to transition what they were doing here, and I needed to get out of downtown. So at that point, a new partnership was formed. And so now Lexington Diner is not 100% gay owned at this point. It had been previously. Now I think my dad will be okay with me saying he's gay. He's not really gay, but we count him as a gay man, even though he's not.
Honorary. Yeah.
Yeah. He's an honorary gay. So.
Yeah. And so what does being owner involve for you? I know you mentioned, it seems like you're probably pretty busy. You mentioned maybe some counseling. You've got like a large staff. What tasks are involved in being the owner of Lexington or one of the owners of Lexington Diner?
It's really, for me, I'm the general manager here. So it's really managing the day-to-day operations of the restaurant itself. I am not a chef, but I'm really good at eating, and I know what good, and I know what good food is, and I know what diner food is. But I'm not an actual chef. I'm a restaurateur, but I'm a restaurant owner at this point in my life. But my job is the daily management of the company, making sure that it's staffed, that it's clean, that it's supplied, that the maintenance is completed. All those things kind of fall under my purview. You know, any kind of creative like campaigns, whether for marketing, those things are kind of with, you know, so anything that has to do with the day-to-day management of the company is run by me.
Okay, gotcha. And what sort of, I know with COVID and everything, maybe things in terms of the diner, it must be a little different than like pre-COVID. How have things been going considering, you know, the pandemic going on?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's been a challenging year, and I would just call it an exercise in change management. Because that's what it really has literally been. It's like, you know, Andy could come on the TV at 4 o'clock and all of a sudden I'm changing everything I'm doing by 5 o'clock tomorrow. I mean, it's been a very challenging year financially. You've got a lot of folks out there that are very nervous and just trying to make sure that we can make those guests as comfortable as possible and feel as safe as they can and come here and have a good meal and enjoy themselves and be able to relax and have a good meal.
Gotcha. And what's the future of the diner right now?
Well, you know, I think that kind of we're hitting our stride. You know, I think we're going to come out of COVID actually stronger. You know, I've got a very cohesive staff and couldn't be happier with the staff that I have right now. And we have all come through this last year together. We haven't had a whole lot of changes in staff. And so that's been a huge blessing. And so I think that now with more people, the rate going down, immunization starting, and hopefully the weather improving, people will start coming out. And I think we're just going to get back on track and be bigger than ever. So And hopefully we're going to have some tea dances and do some things with you all this summer. So, of course, after I had found out about the country's existence, my first thought was, you know what we should have? We should have a tea dance on like a Sunday night. You know, we should have some parties here because I really wanted to celebrate, because I really want to celebrate this new information and this knowledge that this space used to be a queer space. And it's like, hey, there's still gay people here. And really want to celebrate that. And of course, COVID. So right about as soon as I found out that this used to be the country, COVID hit. And then so literally it's like all my ideas that I had were like, we can't do anything like that because of COVID. So, you know, I think that's one of the things I really would love to do is really be able to have it open, have people be able to mingle, have a DJ here and make this back room into a dance floor. And, you know, and have folks come out from the community and just really celebrate this space in a new life. So we've talked about doing something called Diner After Dark, possibly coming up this summer. So and we have just recently added doing we did it before, but we brought back trivia so that people could safely sit at their table and do trivia from their table and not have to get up to kind of get people start getting back out again. So I think that's kind of what's coming this year. And we have done, last Wednesdays. We did a last Wednesdays event here, which was a blast. And I would love to do more things like that in the community, obviously. And I've participated with not only Pride, but with AVOL, Dine Out for Life, every year. So we did it last year, even with COVID. So I assume we'll be doing Dine Out for Life again this year. So, and having, you know, them here in the diner. And we've actually had the sisters here, the Kentucky Fried Sisters, came and did a bingo night here, which was a blast. And introducing this kind of South Side neighborhood to some drag queens. It's been a lot of fun. I mean, when you have a table of seniors sitting next to a table of drag queens, and, you know, a woman who's probably 70 asked me to come over to the table, and she's like, who are these people? And wanted me to explain why there was people there in drag and who they were. And it was Dine Out for Life night, and we had people here in drag. So it's been a really interesting experience having the diner and, you know, that part of us, you know, being gay on the South Side, and, you know, exposing us to gay people and drag to a whole new community.
Right.
Can you hold on 1 second? Can you hold on 1 second for me?
Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
Hold on.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
It's about to go on us.
Oh, no problem. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't realize.
No,
we
you're
find
totally
so many
fine.
Things to talk about.
Yeah, I mean there was you have some big plans for the diner. That's awesome to hear that.
Yeah. We try to have a good time. So.
Yeah, and then obviously I think John mentioned to you that we're hoping to do something. Maybe we could tie it into, you know, the diner at night sort of thing. But yeah, something to do with the country during the summer. But obviously, you know, we'll see
absolutely.
How things happen. Cool. Yeah, we're very grateful for that. And we'll see how things
there
progress.
Was lots of things that were happening before. I mean, and then there was we were looking at another kind of gay community exhibit that was going to be done here. There was an artist that wanted to do an exhibit here where he's doing photographs and interviews with different people and kind of getting their stories. And he had kind of identified us as one of the places in Lexington he kind of wanted to display this work and kind of have it happen. So, and then just COVID just kind of shut down a bunch of projects that we kind of had going. So I'm excited about, you know, the possibility of working with the organization and kind of doing some of those things.
Okay. Yeah.
Most definitely.
Great. And I think I have maybe one more question. And then I was thinking, well, we'll see what the battery permits, but I was thinking, ask one more question. And
Okay. Maybe
you could give me another sort of like 360
sure.
and show me just the interior of
absolutely.
The diner. Okay. So yeah, I just had one
around.
More question. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask, since you've spent a lot of time in Lexington, like as, you know, a younger person and then currently too, and I was wanting to ask you, you know, is there a difference between Lexington then and now as it relates to, you know, the LGBT community? Is it the same is it different in terms of like acceptance, interaction, or, you know, lack of acceptance? What do you think, just in your experience?
I think that the level of acceptance and interaction in the Lexington community is much better. I think this is a very positive community for most gay people. I think there's, you know, I mean, there's possibility of always having a negative experience anywhere in the United States. But I think personally, I feel very safe here. I think I feel safer here now than I did back in the 90s. Back in the 90s, people would yell at me and yell lesbian on campus. I'm like, where? I mean, can you point them out to me and give me some help? I mean, I didn't need them to tell me I was gay. At that point, now a few years before, I could have used some help. But, you know, but I do, to your question, I do think it's a very safe and, from my perspective, it's a safer community now and more positive and more supportive than it was in the mid 90s when I was coming out. But even then I felt reasonably safe here. Then I don't think I felt unsafe here.
Okay.
I mean, I mostly had a bunch of young men in college that didn't know anything yelling at me.
Right.
You know, I mean, I survived all that and the military. So
gotcha. Okay. I think that's about it for, specific questions, but how about a little bit, if your battery can handle it before we finish up, how about a little tour? Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're starting off kind of through it on the back of the restaurant. Let me see. How do I flip this thing around? Oh, okay. That's me. Hi.
Hi.
All right. So let me see. I know there's a way to flip this camera.
Yeah, there's like a some kind of icon probably.
Yeah. Where is it hiding?
Yeah.
Okay. There it is. There we go. Okay. Okay. So we're in the back of the restaurant now. So this is looking forward towards the bar. So this is the back dining room here. And then I'll kind of turn around and show you the back of the room where we were, where I was sitting. Okay. So I was sitting back there tucked out of the way.
Uh-huh.
So, and then we'll pan back around to the bar. And unfortunately, we've got those bright windows up front. So this is the bar. And from what I understand, this is the bar that's been here for a long time. This is kind of a traditional kind of racetrack kind of shape. And this has been here for a long time.
Wow,
it's gotten refinished and it has different finishings on it. But this is the bar area. And then there's booth seating here on this side as well.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. You know, and I think from downtown, we were a little 49-seat restaurant to now where in this space, we're now 170 seats plus the patio. So we've grown up a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and I would at this point kind of describe us as a neighborhood diner, kind of a neighborhood restaurant. All of the artwork on the wall is locally produced or it's actually of Lexington. So these pieces are kind of an homage to downtown where we started. This piece of art hung downtown on the wall outside the building and the fireplace there. And then this piece was actually, I don't see if we can get it. This piece was actually painted by one of our guests. It's hard to get it with the reflections and the lights, but that was painted of our downtown location. So of course, trying to tie those things in together. So we kept kind of true to our core. This is the hallway. This just leads to bathrooms and such here. And then this is the kitchen area. So that's the diner. So, and then I think if we walk down this hall, we'll probably see, and this is some of the famous people that have kind of visited the diner over the years. Oh, and then there's Jenna Jive. So we actually have a burger that is named after her. It's called the Jive. So, I mean, we really probably can continue this conversation another time to talk about the fact that the original diner, all of our burgers were named after drag queens. We didn't even talk about that.
Oh, so, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, all of our burgers on the menu, the original menu, were all named after drag queens.
Cool.
So there's a whole other story for another day.
Okay.
But anyway, so this is a diner. So now you're going to have to come see me.
Yeah, it's a deal for sure. Right, it looks awesome. Yeah, it's huge.
So, that's it.
All right, awesome. Cool. Well, that, you know, basically finishes my questions. Now you're giving me the grand tour. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
I guess I'll reach out over text, because there's like a form that interviewees sign. I would like mail it to you physically and you could sign it. So I'll keep in touch with you about that. And then we'll both keep in touch about, well, one, obviously me going.
That sounds great.
And then two, the summer plans. Hopefully something, you know, with the country project, some sort of like fun event for, you know, people to come by. I had a great time.
Well, I'm just really glad that there's somebody out there that's trying to preserve the history here in Lexington. I mean, Rob Morgan and I have known each other for years and I follow him. And so I'm so grateful for the work that the Institute is doing to preserve our history. So I'm happy to support you all in any way that I can. And hopefully we look forward to having a future where we continue to be involved and we should celebrate.
Okay. So. Awesome. That sounds great, Karen. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Have a good day.
Thanks. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.